Welcome, everyone. You join us once again in our quest to find the fun at funerals, to cackle at cadavers and seek out the mirth in the macabre. You know, all successful creative work, I nearly said comedy then, or possibly even art, all successful creative work takes risks. And the risks that we have taken with this podcast, I think, are twofold. Number one, we are pushing this, let's be frank, flimsy format for sometimes insulting famous people that are in no position to defend themselves because they're dead. Although, to be fair, they probably wouldn't bother even if they were alive. And secondly, we have permitted James to choose his own subjects, which has led us to all sorts of peculiar ideas about what famous actually means. James, what do you say to that?
Well, I think, firstly, I think you're right that, you know, pushing it is probably a good descriptor for the podcast. But we have talked previously about some of the sort of energies I'm able to channel. So, you know, I want to make it very clear, it's not entirely my choosing. I do feel that there is some kind of spiritual guidance, which is, you know, coming through my core to help bring to you the demise of some of our least known but famous people, I think.
You're merely a vessel for communication from beyond the veil. And do you think you model yourself on, I think, was it Eileen Drury, who was Glenn Hoddle's mystic advisor when he was England manager?
I think there is a rule about, you know, in celestial circles, not discussing the powers of others. But I guess I would describe myself maybe as the kind of vacuum in the milk bottle.
Right. Yeah, I've heard you described in many ways, but I'd have to give that on some thought as to if that's the most appropriate. I don't know. And let us progress with our scientific investigations in any case. This time, James, what have I got for you? I am departing a little bit from the amusing death format, which we know and love so much, to focus kind of more on the extraordinary life of my subject today. Hopefully you won't be too disappointed at the lack of an especially grisly death for us all to have a good laugh at.
I think that's probably permitted. I know you have in the past deviated from the parameters of things, but I think now you're legally probably allowed to do that. So yeah, go on, let's give it a kick.
Well, I make this episode 6, so I think there is room for a sort of an organic development in the theme. I mean, I think this very much fits the genre of what we're doing. So let's on with the drama. My candidate today was born in May 1946 in Coulommiers in France, which is north of Paris, and it's also a type of brie cheese. That's a very pleasing French thing, isn't it, for your home village to also have its own special cheese?
I think also there's something statutory, isn't there, about the size of a village in France, where, you know, if there are more than 10 people in a village, they have to produce a cheese, you know, whether there are any cattle or any dairy herd, they still have to produce some kind of physical cheese.
That's right. They have to have their own cheese, they have to be able to buy bread, and they all have to keep geese in their bedrooms. It's very difficult to give you any clues about this person without it becoming immediately obvious who it is, even to you, James, who has spent so much of your life hiding in cellars. But look, I'll have a go. I'll give you clues one by one and see if you can guess before I have to tell you. So this is a gentleman. He was a famous sportsman in the loosest possible sense of the word sport. He was a larger-than-life character, not in many ways, in one very specific way. Any inkling so far?
I'm thinking, as you know, my extensive knowledge of sport is legendary. And my initial thinking is perhaps Kenny Dalglish?
No, I think Kenny Dalglish was born in Glasgow rather than in northern France. And he was definitely a famous sportsman in the strict sense of the word sport, not in the loosest possible sense. But anyway, okay, a few more clues. Let's get a bit more obvious. His professional names included Giant Machine, Monster Rusimov, and he used to get billed as the eighth wonder of the world.
Well, now, you've thrown me now slightly because, you know, as you said, we were looking for a Frenchman. I was thinking perhaps of Maurice Chevalier.
No, not Maurice Chevalier. This guy was extremely famous in his area of let's call it entertainment. As well as being an athlete, sort of, he made a dozen or so TV and film appearances, one in particular that people might recall where he played Physique in The Princess Bride in 1987.
I think we're talking, I think now, aren't we? You've narrowed it down slightly for me. We're talking now about someone who perhaps makes money from sort of grappling other gentlemen. Is that where we are?
Yeah, absolutely. So now we're honing in on something you're much more interested in. Is a name presenting itself? You're absolutely in the right area.
I can see in my mind a large man with big muscles, but that's not unusual for this time of day. But I'm thinking someone who looks a little bit like the Incredible Hulk, but isn't.
Yes, that's right. He also, just on the theme of his TV and film appearances, he also played Bigfoot in two episodes of The $6 Million Man. And I haven't seen it. I haven't seen those episodes. What I don't know is whether he actually played Bigfoot or that was just the name of his character. I suspect, frankly, it was the former. Do you have any insight on that?
No, not really. The size of this gentleman is probably the most significant thing about him, isn't it? I would say, rather than his sporting or acting prowess.
Correct.
Would it be fair to say that he got known because he was, absolutely massive, I think is probably the scientific term I'd use?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. And I actually, in one of my early clues, have given you his name, his surname, certainly Rusimov. Shall I put you out of your misery or do you want to have a guess?
No, tell me his name because, I can't even spell Rusimov. I'm trying to write that down as we're talking and it's not going very well. So, put me out of my misery.
So his actual name was Andrei Rusimov, also known as Andre the Giant from the world of wrestling.
Andre the Giant. Now, how long do you think it took them to come up with that as a sort of nom de guerre?
Yeah, well, to be fair, it's reasonably descriptive because his name was Andre and boy, was he a giant. And we'll come on to his dimensions in a minute. But just before we get on to his life and his demise, I've done my usual Wikipedia test on famous Andres. So if you type in the word Andre and hit pause on the E, it throws up a list of suggested people. There's only, I think there's five that are suggested, one of whom is already Andre the Giant. And others are variations on the word Andre, including the word Andrew. So do you think you can name any of the other four famous Andres or Andrews?
I'm guessing that on that list is mulleted impresario Andre Rey.
No, who's that?
Andre the Giant is who we're talking about. So let's think of other famous. Andre McTavish, the leader of the Jacobite Rebellion.
I think this is focusing on real people rather than ones that you've made up. And bear in mind, there are two Andrews, two famous Andrews on this list, as well as Andres.
Is it Andre Melly? Is he on there?
Who's that? That's
Prince
a lady,
Andrew,
isn't it?
Is he on there? Someone non-controversial.
No, Prince Andrew's not on there. Andre Agassi, the tennis player, is the other famous Andre, the 80s, 90s tennis player, noted for his lovely curly locks and subsequently for his lovely bald head. The Andrews that you missed are...
Is he real?
Yeah, very real, yeah, from Las Vegas, I think. The Andrews that you missed, you could have had former US President Andrew Jackson, about whom I know nothing, and you could have had musical impresario Andrew Lloyd Webber.
And Andrew Ridgely.
True. Yeah, I would have allowed that, although that wasn't on the Wikipedia list. The final entry, you'll have to take a view on this, was on Anders Breivik, the Norwegian murderer.
I think in terms of being complete, I think we could probably allow him to be on the list. If you're going to allow Andrews, I think you can allow that.
I think we should move swiftly on from him. Okay, let's look at Andre's early life. And I've got some amazing facts about him, which I'm sure will wow the crowds. So he was born in France. It quickly became apparent that he was pretty big. He was actually 13 pounds at birth, which is about nearly double the average birth weight. And how tall do you think he was by the age of 12?
Well, I'm imagining when he was born at that weight, he would have been about sort of 3 or 4 foot. So by the age of 12, I'm thinking he's probably reached 7 feet.
He was 6'3" by the age of 12. And he actually had a form of gigantism, which is a medical condition. But he wasn't formally diagnosed until he was an adult. He was wrestling in Japan, age 24. The doctors there examined him and said, yep, you've got gigantism. I suspect they may have had some suspicions already by that point that there was something going on, but he was confirmed when he was 24. It's caused, if you want to know, it's caused by a benign tumor that grows on the pituitary gland or presses on the pituitary gland causing overproduction of a growth hormone. So people just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And at least two other fairly famous wrestlers have had the same condition. It's less common these days because you can do an operation on the gland to try and control the problem, so people don't get quite so big. But anyway, yeah, so he was 13 pounds at birth. He grew to 6'3" by the age of 12. He left school at 14, worked as a farm labourer. According to his brother, he did the work of three men as a labourer. And then aged about 18, he moved to Paris and got involved in wrestling. He was quickly picked up by a promoter who saw that, you know, because of his immense size, he was going to be pretty, pretty sensational in the ring. So they stuck him in the ring. But by this point, he was over 7 feet tall. And he rapidly became, you know, pretty much unbeatable in the ring just because of his size. And in fact, he became the victim of his success fairly early on in his career because he had no plausible opponents in most, you know, wrestling franchises. I mean, it must have been like trying to wrestle with a minibus, you know, bring down an oak tree. So he got loaned out around the world. He traveled all over the world wrestling with different networks to sort of stop people getting bored of him being totally dominant. And he actually went on to great success in wrestling, became a household name in that, you know, in that arena into the 70s. And in the 1980s, you know, he won the WWF heavyweight title in 1988. By this time, so this was kind of getting towards the end of his wrestling career. By this time, he was billed as 7'4" in height, which is probably a slight exaggeration, but he was definitely over 7 feet tall. And I think we should note that in his younger days, whilst he was never muscular in the way that a lot of wrestlers are, he was, you know, reasonably proportionate. But by the late 80s, let's be honest, he became immensely fat. And in 1988, he was billed as weighing, have a guess at his build weight in the late 1980s in stone.
I'm going to take an educated guess at this and say that he was 25 stone.
He was billed at 37 stone.
Wow.
236 kilograms. But his opponent in 1987 and 1988, Hulk Hogan, suggested that this number was a significant underestimate. How heavy do you think Hogan thought Andre was at this point?
I reckon that he was probably concerned that he was in excess of 40 stone.
Hogan reckoned he was 700 pounds, 50 stone.
Wow.
And Hogan body slammed him. I picked him up sort of, you know, with one arm sort of between Andre's legs, flipped him upside down and slammed him onto the mat. Hogan did that to him and tore his shoulder off in the act. So he would know. 50 stone, Hogan reckoned. I mean, that. So he was maybe 7'4", certainly over 7 feet, and somewhere between 40 and 50 stone. I mean, that is just astonishing proportions, isn't it? Weirdly, he increasingly had health problems related to his size and weight, and his wrestling career kind of petered out in the early 90s. And even by that point, he'd not been a serious competitor for many years, really. He was just absolutely gigantic. But would you like to hear some amazing facts about Andre the Giant?
I would. And one thing I was just going to ask you there is whether when he was growing up, when he was younger, do you think he managed to sort of turn the table on his parents? You know, because you know how your mum and dad, when you're growing up, you complain about your clothes not fitting properly, and it's either, oh, don't worry, you'll grow into them, or, you know, there's plenty of growing room and all that kind of stuff. I imagine that very quickly he, you know, made the trousers look like the Incredible Hulk's trousers. So you probably, he said, ah, you're not laughing now, are you? I've put my toe through these shoes you bought yesterday.
I mean, you kind of think when you're 6'3" by the age of 12, when your mother says, if you don't eat the rest of your porridge for your breakfast, young man, what are you going to do to Andre the Giant? Nothing, mother. That's what you're going to do. Shut up. But actually, I think just from doing a little bit of research about him, like a lot of oversized people, he was actually quite a gentle, nice person in real life. He wasn't an aggressive person. He was known to be very, very generous with his money. He was a big earner in the 1970s. He was the highest paid wrestler for a lot of the 1970s in the world. And he was known to be very generous and kind. And, he was supposed to be a pretty good guy. But look, here's some amazing facts about him. He was a bit of a drinker. And when you're 7'4" and nearly 50 stone, you can stick it away, I think it is fair to say. He had a prodigious drinking capacity. So here's some of his and you know I'm a fan of listing some drinking escapades, because we did talk about Oliver Reed in a previous one of these episodes, didn't we? And he had some pretty impressive statistics under his belt. But stand aside, Oliver, because here comes Andre. Andre once drank 119 US beers in 6 hours. That is 72 pints.
That's some going, isn't it? 72 pints.
72. So this was 119 350 ml beers, so kind of like a Coke can sort of size, yeah, in 6 hours, 72 pints. And then that's just for starters. A witness said...
With only one toilet break, apparently. Is that right?
I don't know if he... Yeah, I mean, the toilet break is not reported. I mean, yeah, did he even ever go to the toilet? A witness said that Andre once drank 156 large beers, 470 ml, so not quite a pint, but not far off. 156 beers in one sitting, and this was confirmed by... So somebody wrote this and somebody else, another wrestler called Dusty Rhodes, said, yes, that was true, I was there. 156 beers. That's 73 litres of beer, or 128 imperial pints.
That is staggering, isn't it? And again, you know, as you pointed out earlier, it's surprising, isn't it, in later life that he developed any kind of health problem, really. You'd think that would keep him fit and agile, really.
Isn't that unusual? Here's my favourite story. I've got a couple more of these. This is my favourite one. A wrestler in her autobiography wrote that she was touring with Andre in the northern US, and that one night in a hotel bar in Pennsylvania, Andre drank 127 beers and subsequently passed out in the lobby of the hotel on the floor. The staff obviously could not move him, so they threw a horse blanket over him and left him. They just left him there until he woke up 16 hours later.
Well, that could have been quite inconvenient, I guess, for the other guests, couldn't it? Nipping out to the machine in the night.
Well, can you? I mean, some hotels you go and have got quite a small kind of lobby area. You know, there might only be, you know, the counter and a kind of a bench and a couple of places to stand. And, you know, they can be quite small. So imagine finding a 7 foot giant comatose with reeking of beer, just flat out in there, covered in a huge blanket. It's quite an image, that is. In a drinking contest over a 9 hour period, he was reported to have drunk 116 beers. There's another story about him prior to a very famous wrestling match, WrestleMania 3, 1987 or 88. Prior to a match, he drank 14 bottles of wine in one sitting.
That's something, is it? Was it British wine?
Very probably. Why not? Yeah, let's say it was British. Would he have drunk British wine in America? I don't know where that WrestleMania match took place.
I think being French, being a real connoisseur of wine, I think British wine is probably what he would go for, really, wouldn't he? You know, he would know his onions, as it were.
I wouldn't put any money on that. And then there's a couple of other things about him. One is that he had to have some surgery in 1987, and his size and his weight was so far off the charts that the doctors couldn't estimate the correct dosage of anaesthetic for him. So what they had to essentially guess how much to give him based on his alcohol tolerance and use that as a guideline instead. I mean, I personally suspect they probably ended up getting in a vet to use elephant tranquilizers on him.
It's highly likely. Now, I was going to ask you mentioned the Princess Bride earlier on, okay? Mm. Which, you know, as I mentioned at the start, I do occasionally, I have apparitions, or I have, you know, messages, strong spiritual, I'm going to call them prods, because that's probably the best way to describe them. And I've got a feeling that amongst some of the celebrities we've discussed, Andre is probably the only one who had absolute full access to Narnia, who could actually access Narnia. And that's partly how he got that part.
Hmm. Final Andre amazing fact. And for me, this is the most astonishing of all. He had a daughter. He had a daughter, presumably with a normal lady. Just imagine the process of conception in that circumstance, if you will. Terrifying.
I'm actually, as you can, if you can hear, I'm actually drawing that. I'm not feeling very well. They were remarkable. What a legacy.
Indeed. Yeah. Actually, a little bit of a sad side note, footnote to that story, that he was an absentee father and didn't really know his daughter or spend any time with her. So a little bit of a cloud there on Andre's character, unfortunately, but there you go. This brings us, unless you have any other questions, James, this brings us to the demise
Well, I was just going to say, you know, in terms of that consummation, as I could call it, do you think there was a stepladder involved, maybe some plumbing tools? How do you think that practically that was achieved? Is that something you want to explore, or are you still in a cold sweat?
I think this is a very, I'm not sure it would be wise to thoroughly explore the circumstances and the, you know, what went on that occasion. This was in the early 70s, I think. Not sure it bears thinking about, to be honest. I think
we'll leave it at your description.
Draw a discreet veil over that and move to the demise. This is usually the high point to the tale, isn't it, James? Because of the tragic, or perhaps a better word would be hilarious, death of our subjects, all of whom obviously are carefully chosen for this very purpose, to amuse us exactly the way they would have all wanted to be remembered, I'm sure. James, would I be right in thinking that you do not recall exactly how Andre died when he did pass away in January 1993?
It is true. I don't recollect the circumstances. And also, just to build on what you just said, you know, these are the saddest parts, if you like, of these stories usually, and the bits I most look forward to. So, you know, carry on, please. I'm eager to learn.
Good. Did I say hilarious? Sorry, I meant sad and tragic. So he died in 1993. He was only 46 years old. So, and I think, like a lot of people who suffer from this gigantism disease or illness, they are not very long lived, and that is very sad. And genuinely, you know, there's no intent to poke fun at people who suffer from this nasty condition, and thankfully it's happening less and less often as medical science has progressed. So our conscience is clear now, James, we can dive in. So as you don't recall how Andre passed away, I'm going to give you three possible scenarios, one of which is correct, and I want you to guess which you think is the right one. Okay, so I'm going to give you three scenarios. One is the right answer. You've got to guess.
I'm set. I've aligned my chakra and I'm open to receive.
Splendid. Okay, number one, he suffered congestive heart failure whilst on a visit to Paris, and his body had to be airlifted back to the USA in an otherwise empty Vulcan bomber.
Okay, you want me to choose from the three you're going to present, yeah?
Yeah, let me do number two and three, and then you can talk me through your thinking and take a guess. So that's number one, congestive heart failure on a visit to Paris, and his body had to be airlifted back to the USA on a Vulcan bomber. Number two, he suffered a fatal organ failure after going on a drinking binge in Toronto, where he consumed 79 beers and 9 bottles of wine, and the wall of his hotel room had to be demolished in order to extract his body using a pallet truck. And finally, number three, your final choice, your final option, he suffered a stroke whilst attempting to climb over a fence in a muddy field in North Carolina, whilst under the influence of medical-grade marijuana, and his body had to be retrieved on a wagon pulled by a team of 8 horses. So, heart failure in Paris, fatal organ failure after a drinking binge in Toronto, or stroke after trying to climb over a fence in Carolina and having to be retrieved by a wagon pulled by a team of 8 horses.
So all three of those, I think, are highly plausible. And I think, you know, it's highly possible that any of those could happen. But I'm going to go with answer number two, which is the Canadian orgasm, I think, and demolishing half a hotel room to get him out.
Excellent. Good. That's the wrong one. No, I made that one up. He did not suffer fatal organ failure after going on a drinking binge in Toronto. The correct answer is actually number one. He did suffer a congestive heart failure on a visit to Paris. His body was airlifted back to the USA. I slightly embroidered the facts by suggesting that he was flown back on an otherwise empty Vulcan bomber. I mean, he was sort of 40 to 50 stone, so presumably he just took up kind of 3 seats on a normal plane, and probably as long as they sat him near the middle down the central axis of the plane, he probably travelled on relatively normal planes, I would have thought, not very comfortably for him. How would he have got in a car?
Good. These are good practical questions, and I was thinking that was a stinker as well, that one, because, you know, a Vulcan bomber is purely something out of Star Trek, isn't it? You know, we know that Vulcans aren't real things. I guess getting in a car, he probably would have had the biggest car he could, and he might have put a bit of olive oil on his arms, maybe help him squeeze through, maybe get one of those special steering wheels that goes up and down.
Can you imagine what he would have looked like getting in and out of a car, and what that car, the list, I mean, he must have had to buy cars that were specially reinforced. He owned a farm in North Carolina. That's what he liked when he wasn't wrestling. He liked sort of messing around. You know, he kept horses and you know, dairy animals and things, and he liked dogs. And you know, he was kind of, you know, he grew up on a farm. That was his kind of natural environment, and he was very happy there, I think. You know, outside where he couldn't bang his head on, you know, beams and things like that. He must have had to buy cars with reinforced suspension and specially adapted to allow him to get in and out, don't you think? He must have had maybe some kind of truck or something that he used to sit in.
I think he may have had something like a Daewoo or a Chevrolet Matiz, I think they're known. And it's quite a small car. You can get 6 to 10 people in them, but not legally. I think he probably had one of them for each of his feet, you know, because he used them as roller skates.
I think you're right. I think he did have a relatively modest family saloon, but with just one seat in the middle. That's probably how he did it.
I think it's more sensible. And if you imagine living in the same cul-de-sac as he did, you imagine sort of seeing him parking it and going out on a daily basis. It must have been, you know, almost like the sort of opening scenes to a kids' TV show.
When you see pictures of him, you know, if you just Google a picture of him and you see him in his sort of black leotard, which is, you know, a little unflattering, I think it's fair to say. When you see him next to kind of people of more common height, I'm trying to phrase that very carefully, clearly there is something very unusual about his aspect. I mean, I'm looking at a picture of him standing sort of next to a crowd of people watching him wrestle, and there's a sort of a police officer or a security guard who is presumably a grown man who comes up to sort of halfway up Andre's chest, as does everybody else in the audience, including people up to about 10 rows back. And his head is at least, I mean, literally double or treble the size of a normal head. And I mean, the top of his legs are level with the badge on this police officer's, you know, shirt uniform. I mean, in the picture I'm looking at, he is just, the scale is just absolutely immense. And it's just an astonishing person. Anyway, look, I mean, I think we've plumbed the depths of Andre, James, unless you have anything else you'd like to ask about him.
I guess I was just thinking about the other challenge for him in that industry. As you know, it is something that is heavily merchandised, and you know, people like to buy little wrestlers and little figures, don't they, to play with at home. I can imagine that, you know, the toy companies flagging the fact that, you know, an Andre figure was actually the equivalent of three other action figures, so probably had to be, you know, slightly more heavily priced, and therefore, you know, the kids maybe didn't go for Andre because they couldn't afford the £40 versus the £10 for the action figure.
I think that was probably right. And but think of the accessories that you could have bought with those dolls. You would have had to go, you know, buy sort of, you know, 6 crates of beer, 2 crates of wine, a horse blanket to throw over him in case he passed out in, you know, maybe a portable sort of hotel lobby for him to pass out in after he drank 116 beers. You know, you've
Vulcan bomber funeral playset.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, there's limitless commercial opportunity to merchandise him. And I think, to be honest, his career was kind of winding up when that kind of industry was really getting going. So it's a bit unfortunate that he probably didn't get all the benefit from that, those opportunities, which would have come had he been born a bit later. But there you go. Anyway, look, Andre Rusimov, a.k.a. Andre the Giant, 7'4", 50 stone. We salute you. And that was the way he went.
Hello, I'm Jack Humphries.
And I'm Danny Danson.
And this time we're talking about dinner parties. Well, the table is set, the velvet is ironed, and the pantry is bleached.
It's good manners to compliment your guests on arrival, even if you're forced to tell a little white lie. For example, what lovely perfume, Marguerite. I've always been so fond of creosote. Oh, what a colourful Macintosh, Jack. Reminds me of the curtains in my favourite Portuguese brothel.
I like to use my finest bone china Madagascan lover's plates. Although the graphics are a little traditional, they do allow for a good old mopping up of the chilled brine and winkles.
Always serve soup as an entree, or at the very least, seafood or ostrich in a hearty lime swirl jus.
Conversation can be tricky at dinner parties. Avoid topical and controversial bantering with this neat icebreaker. Wasn't it much nicer when the map was pink and the locals all did what they were coerced to?
You'll need a good supply of napkins, which can be useful to cover one's lower personal area in the event of self-shating, which can be a problem, especially if, like me, you serve Turkish figs by the square yard. A discreet puking bucket may also come in handy tucked behind the table leg.
Always review your guest list. I like to ensure that my local circle is well represented, inviting the Rear Admiral, the Postmaster, Matron's Lover Gerald, and Sir Arthur Boson Fetlock.
Before cook brings out the tripe roulade or spam fritters in custard, you should turn to the person on your left and offer them a cigar. Unless, of course, they are a lady, in which case you should turn to your right for the next 3 hours.
Why not try these simple starter dishes? Murdered skate in cherry froth, London-style goat's fist, pureed meatloaf, or, for a real treat, muffled albatross on ginger nuts.
I love parlour games after dinner, if you still have your powers of speech. I like pin the tail on the whoopsie, and my wife Desdemona likes to sing wailing songs that some of her many sailor friends have taught her. Some of the language is a little bit choice, I'm afraid.
Yes, when Desi's had a couple, the language is worse than a bleeding stoker's reunion.
Thank you, Jack. The best way to finish off a meal is coffee, eggs, biscuits, nuts, mustard, oysters and fenugreek. Then it's time for a stroll down to the gunroom for a couple of stiff tots of brandy, Belgian whiskey, cherry brandy, Dutch whiskey, and a light absinthe. Welsh, if you can get it, you can really taste the saltpeter.
A fine selection, Danny. Hard to choose.
No need for choice, Jack. It's one of each, just like Mother. Better bring some extra napkins.
Should you need to visit the ablutions room during tiffin, simply use this accepted society phrase. Excuse me, brethren. I'm off to drop the nut on the parrot's foot.
Or if suffering from shating, the parrot's wing.
Follow those easy steps for a simply fantastic dinner party. I'm looking forward to it already, aren't you, Danny?
Well, yes, in a way.
Good-o. We'll see you again soon.
Pip, pip.
So we're going to move now to a figure who I think is both revered and cherished, really, in many ways. We're talking about someone who's quite unusual, I think, in terms of the spheres of influence that they had and the worlds in which they worked. We're talking about someone who was a singer-songwriter and a producer, but also an activist and a politician. And that's not entirely unique, because a number of people in those trades, you know, sort of cross one into the other. You know, often people get elected and they decide to make a pop single, or you know, the other side is true, where, you know, a pop single helps people establish an electoral mandate for reform. So it's not unheard of. But we're talking about an American who was born in Detroit and really started songwriting when he became a teenager. That's when he sort of started to get into music. And we're going to talk a little bit about his music career. But the other fact I'm going to throw at you first, Dave, just to see if you've any idea who this character may be, is that politically he was a real advocate for liberty and freedom and against bureaucracy. And one of his legacies, I think, is being instrumental in the extension of copyright law in the United States. So any ideas who this wonderful character might be?
I mean, you're not exactly giving it away. So this is a man born in Detroit. I don't think you said when. What was the year of birth?
He was born in 1935.
1935, in the music industry, and then moved into politics and was a big advocate of copyright law. Well, I mean, that's the long list, isn't it? No, I need more clues. I'm sorry. When you first started talking, my immediate reaction was it must be Sue Pollard, but given some of the subsequent facts, I think I'm going to have to row back from that. So I will give you the floor. Please put some more clues out for me.
Sadly as well, I think Sue Pollard is still with us, so we'd have to rule her out. The rules of the game, as it were. Now, this character, this man, is the only, still to this day, the only member of Congress who has scored a number one pop single on the US Billboard Hot 100 chart. What an accolade that is. So, you know, he kind of really, I suppose, had a dual life in many ways. And that's a bit of a clue, that word dual. I'm going to come back to that a little bit later.
Is this person a member of a musical family in any way?
I guess he's the origin of a musical family. Let's say that. And, you know, okay. I might explain some of those bits as we drudge through the fitting tribute to this person.
Is he one of the Osmonds?
No, he's not one of the Osmonds. So that's your second strike out there. As I said, he started songwriting when he was fairly young in his teenage years, and he actually dropped out of high school to follow his dream in the music business, which had limited success as well, I think, because, you know, he did what most musicians have to do. He kind of worked as a waiter, and he worked in a butcher's shop as well, and he worked in a nuclear power plant and all those kind of those things. But in the 60s, where everything was happening, I guess, in terms of the music industry, Phil Spector was somebody that he worked for. So the producer, Phil Spector, he worked for Phil Spector as a percussionist and is loosely called a gopher in the trade. Now, that's different, I think. I want to be clear here. This is different from a fluffer, because that's a role in a different industry and a different media. So he worked as a gopher for Phil Spector. And it's at this point where he becomes, I suppose, interested in pop, and he gets exposure to other artists and other singers. And he forms a very famous partnership, an important partnership, which lasts for quite a few decades. So any nearer to who this is?
Oh, God, not really. It's not one of Paul Simon or Art Garfunkel, presumably.
No, I think they're both still alive as well.
Oh, so, yeah, sadly. Yeah, that's true.
We can't have them.
I'm struggling with this one, James. Keep going.
I'm going to give you some killer facts now. And I think from this, you will guess who this is. And this is on the entertainment side of this character. In 1975, he stars in the TV movie Murder on Flight 502. Okay. He's also seen a number of times in The Golden Girls, the popular sitcom in the 80s and 90s, as a bit part walk-on character, usually in dream sequences. But he was also, he appeared in the Men in Black film in 1997.
Oh, I've got absolutely no idea. Glenn Medeiros, Barry Manilow.
In terms of kudos, I think you're quite close. In terms of, you know, who this person is, those people you've mentioned are not that far from the kind of character that we're talking about.
Not Tommy Lee Jones, who would be about the right age, maybe. Not Will Smith, obviously. I'm thinking about Men in Black now. And a pop singer, briefly, and I've got no, keep going. I've got no idea.
Okay, well, I'll talk a little bit about perhaps his political career. That might help you. This is a guy who became a politician. He became mayor of Palm Springs, okay? That's where he first started. So a significant office, as you know, in the US of States. And he later, in the sort of mid-90s, late 90s, became congressman. He became one of the Republican congressmen for California. So he started to build his profile. And he did that really because, as I touched on at the start, he wanted to combat bureaucracy. He was fed up of the machine and the big state. And he was really, really aggrieved by a lot of the sort of social injustice that he saw that a big state created. And I think for him, the most important issue of the day and the most pertinent thing that he had to resolve were a number of challenges that he had in opening his own restaurant locally. So he really had people's interests at heart. You know, he was a real man of the people.
I think in my opening address to this recording, James, I made a passing reference to the fact that you have something of a tendency to pick rather obscure, if you don't mind me saying so, candidates that nobody's heard of. I kind of feel that that position has been somewhat borne out by your choice in this episode. I still have got no idea. He was a California congressman, did you say? So I don't
to give you too much of a clue, I think he represented the 44th district in California. So that I think that probably gives it away, doesn't it?
But I tell you what, why don't you tell me his name and then we'll see if that rings any bells.
I might not go that far, but what I will do is I'll tell you the name of his singing partner, okay, of the person who, as a duo, we probably know him through, okay? So he started this duo right at the beginning of the 60s, and it became a very popular singing duo, but also it led on to TV comedy shows. They had hits with tracks I Got You, Babe, and The Beat Goes On. Okay, are we getting closer there?
Yes, it's Sonny from Sonny and Cher, isn't it?
We are talking, you're absolutely right, we are talking about Salvatore Philip Bono, okay, also known as Sonny. And I thought initially he was still alive because I thought, you know, you two have released lots of records recently and they've been on tour in the last couple of years. And then I realized that actually Sonny Bono isn't the lead singer of U2. He's somebody different. And that was a bit of a revelation for me because vocally, There's very little difference, I think. So, you know, perhaps people after listening to this will want to go and explore that a little more. Now, the relationship, the partnership with Cher was, you know, I suppose an accelerant for his musical aspirations, really. He was, I think, an established songwriter and a very accomplished musician as well, in terms of a lyricist, I think, and a percussionist. That's where he came from. But through that partnership with Cher, he began to kind of turbocharge, if you like, some of the things that he was able to do. Now, he was also married four times. So Cher was his second wife, I think, as well as his musical singing partner, which made Early Mornings awkward. But he also went on to work with Cher after they divorced. And, you know, and some of the television comedy was after that fact. So, you know, it was a real strong friendship and relationship there. Really. So let's pause there and get your kind of reflection on Bono.
I mean, it won't take very long because, to be absolutely frank, I know very little of him. I seem to recall him having quite an impressive tash. And there are videos of him singing with Cher going back to I think they had a TV show in the 60s in America, didn't they? And he had quite an impressive tash. I've got in my mind a picture that he looks something like Charles Bronson, the movie star of that kind of era, 70s. Other than that, I know nothing at all about him. So I'm sorry. You'll have to enlighten me, James, as to what he's been up to and particularly how he checked out.
Well, you're quite right. There is a svelte Bronson comparison there, I think. But, you know, the moustache was not initially, but in later years, you know, the moustache was, I guess, the draw, you know, irresistible to women and men and dogs, I think, at some point. But we won't go into that for now. So I'll tell you a little bit more about him, and then we'll move to the demise, really. He did take on this cause around copyright, you know, and trying to extend copyright laws for a further 20 years in the States. So, you know, the artists and musicians got a fair share, really, of things that they'd written and produced. And again, you know, in support of his work to combat bureaucracy, to further his own restaurant interests, here again, he's taking up a cause which directly links to his own personal income. So he's a real, you know, again, he's a real people person. And I think probably one of the best things to do is to give you an idea of some of the tributes that have been paid and dedicated to Sonny Bono after his death. He died sadly in 1998. And just some of the honours, I suppose we'll call them, is he has a Golden Palm Star on the Palm Springs Walk of Stars, which was dedicated to him in 1996, just a couple of years before he died. So
makes it all worthwhile.
A real showbiz legend, and I think, and you know, part of that. I mentioned the copyright legislation, which is formally called the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, extended copyright protections effective from October 27, 1998. So, you know, if you can have some kind of statutory instrument named after you, I think, you know, that is, you have made it in many ways.
And it's so important to all of us even today, isn't it? So, you know, he really did make his mark, you know, to defending all of our interests.
There is a 40-mile stretch of the interstate highway near Palm Springs, which was dedicated to him and is called the Sonny Bono Memorial Freeway. Brings a whole new meaning to I've just hopped on the Sonny in the morning. And finally, there is a memorial fountain and statue in downtown Palm Springs. You and I have probably seen it on our G&T sprig, and that was dedicated to him in 2002. But let's talk importantly about the demise. Now, there's nothing to laugh at here, Dave, and I want you to be very open and compassionate with me in terms of your reaction to this. There were suggestions at the time that Sonny had a number of issues with narcotics and addiction, but that was unfounded and unproven, and there were no traces of anything such as that following the inquiry into his death. But he, very sadly, whilst out skiing, he was a very keen skier. He loved to be out on the slopes, singing and writing new songs, I think, in his head, and also coming up with amendments to pieces of legislation as well in his mind at the time. And he hit a tree while he was skiing, head on, hit a tree, and it killed him. So a bit of a sad way to go, really.
I mean, presumably the tree was then immediately indicted for second or even first degree murder. I mean, that's the way things happen in the US, I think, in their justice system.
And copyright infringement as well, because they'd used an impression of the artist rather than actually getting permission.
Indeed, which I think under the act which Sonny had shepherded in, you know, became a more serious offence than murder in the US, in fact, doesn't it?
Indeed. I think that also the sort of parting gesture is very touching in this story as well, because at his funeral, Cher, his former wife and media partner, she gave a eulogy at Sonny's funeral, and he was buried in the Desert Memorial Park in Cathedral City, California. And his headstone bears the epitaph, "And the beat goes on." You know, I think that's beautiful, isn't it? You know, "And the beat goes on." What a lovely thing to have.
What a lovely tribute. Wasn't he also at some point accused, maybe even successfully prosecuted, for assaulting Cher? So I'm just wondering if there was a slight subtext to the reference to beat. I don't know. Maybe that's a scurrilous and inappropriate comment, James, but if you've researched his life thoroughly, and I'm sure you have read several biographies of him in preparation for this recording, is there any reference to... Was there domestic violence in that relationship with Cher, or have I made that up?
There isn't any reference to that in the 14 biographies that I've
14. Okay, I think that's enough to give a fair. Okay, well, in that case, I withdraw those allegations.
There was an allegation of Scientology, though. There was a suggestion that he was linked to the Church of Scientology, which we've got to be careful about, you know, what we say about, given particularly my preference for spiritual energies and, you know, and my own particular belief.
I was going to say that, right? That's absolutely your cup of tea, I would think. So no wonder you were drawn like a magnet to researching him. That's very interesting.
He was adamant throughout his life, and in fact, his wife went on to defend this further, that he was a Roman Catholic and he hadn't at any point been formally part of the Church of Scientology. And I have to say, Dave, when I get back onto the mothership and see the Grand
Hi-ya,
I will ask that question, because I think it's an important thing if someone has escaped.
Indeed, yes, they must be brought to... Well, I mean, it's all starting to add up now, isn't it? I mean, the intervention of the tree was clearly, you know, could have been linked back to Scientology. I don't know. So he was skiing and he hit a tree and died. I mean, how old was he when he died?
I think if my maths tells me, he was about 63. Yes, which is not that old, really, is it? So a bit of a sad departure.
That's very sad. I mean, actually, James, to be fair, that is a classic entry, I think, in the annals of these recordings, because it's tragic. It's a horrible accident, and I'm sure for his friends and family and beneficiaries of his vital legislation, it was very, very tragic, and it is tragic. But at the same time, it's also quite funny. Just saying that doesn't change whether people find his manner of death funny or not. It kind of goes beyond an opinion to be a fact, doesn't it, that someone hitting a tree and dying is, I don't know, isn't it just funny? I mean, it's horrible and awful, but this is the nub of what we've been talking about in some of these recordings, you know, whether it's gallows humor, you know, where humor being a lens for analyzing, examining, understanding, accepting the tragic end to people's lives, and everybody who lives will die. That's just, it's one way to analyze and understand, isn't it?
It is a fleshy pocket, if I can use that phrase, in the Venn diagram between hilarity and horror. I think that's very much where this sits. So Sonny Bono there, sadly, that was the way he went.